All right. Well, greetings and welcome to the
April edition of the 2025 Masterclass. This monthly session is designed for current DMSC students and faculty members, and frankly, anyone interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences at A.T. Still University. We have the privilege of hearing from remarkable masters in the PA profession and in healthcare who have greatly influenced our field. Before we dive in, I have a few reminders for our participants. Please ensure your microphones are muted. You're encouraged to share comments or questions in the chat during the presentation. We'll have a Q&A segment at the end where you can unmute to speak. Dr. Beth Popray, our program manager, will be monitoring the chat for any queries or feedback. But anyway, we'll move on. It's really an honor for me to introduce our guest today, Glenn E. Combs. Glenn is a pioneering PA who has significantly shaped PA education and practice in the United States. A 1973 graduate of Alderson Broaddus University, he served in diverse clinical roles spanning emergency medicine, surgery, OB-GYN, family medicine, and psychiatry. Glenn has led two major PA programs as department chair of the University of Kentucky in 78 to 89 and Wake Forest School of Medicine 89 to 04, where he advanced the program to offer master's degrees. His national leadership includes serving twice as president of the American Academy of Physician Assistants, now Physician Associates. That was in 85 to 86 and 2000 to 2001. And also as a commissioner for the National Commission on the Certification of PAs, 88 to 97. Glenn has advocated for the profession before Congress and state legislators, helping establish early PA practice legislation and promoting the commissioning of Navy PAs. A distinguished fellow of the AAPA and author of multiple textbook chapters, Glenn has received numerous honors, including Kentucky PA of the Year, the NCCPA Outstanding Service Award, and an honorary doctorate in education from the Alderson Broaddus University. His commitment to advancing PA education and expanding clinical practice opportunities has left an enduring impact on the profession. And I could go on and on, but I'd rather get on to talk to Glenn. Glenn, welcome to our master class.
Lenny, it's good to be here with you.
And we're really eager
To
to.
hear about your journey to the PA profession, particularly your early experiences in PA school. As one of the early PA graduates from Alderson Broaddus University, tell us a little bit about Alderson Broaddus, and I know that's something that's near and dear to you. And then what drew you to the profession when it was so relatively new?
Well, it's been quite a journey, to say the least. I guess it began looking back about 1968. I grew up in California and now live in North Carolina. In 1960, I was attending San Diego State University, majoring in clinical psychology. I was working as an RN to really finance my tuition at San Diego State. And at that time, I received a nice letter and a copy of an article about the PA and Duke University.
I
And
sent you email.
what's that?
Oh, go ahead. I think that was just a microphone issue.
That's okay. Anyway, I read an interest that article and then did a little bit of research in the library, spent time. But there wasn't too many articles at the time because the concept itself was so new. But I really felt after that research that I knew what I wanted to do, and that was to become a PA. And I wanted to practice medicine, which was a little bit more above a level wise that I was performing as an RN. So the idea of practicing medicine and going away. Now, this was a very turbulent time in my life. The Vietnam War was on, and my draft card was at 89. So the probability of me going to Vietnam was very likely. So I went after a student deferment and applied to Duke University. And at that particular time, I met a corpsman who told me about a program in West Virginia. I didn't think too much of it because both of us felt that we were going to be accepted at Duke. It didn't go that way. I was admitted, but I was admitted for the following year, following class year. Anyway, that was sort of the beginning itself. And I applied to AB after I knew that I wasn't going to get into Duke at that time. Again, I needed to do something fairly quickly. I had about 72 hours to put all my worldly possessions in my Ford Mustang after I was accepted at AB, and drive 2,800 miles across the country to a little town of Phillippi, West Virginia, which was a coal mining community at the time, but it had a great college, and the director of the program, who was Hugh C. Myers, was a gentle Southern gentleman that was a surgeon, and he was the one that early established the PA program. And I was in the second class. There was a 1972 class, and but I and my wife were in 1973. Now, I have to keep in mind that being from California, loving the beach and surfing, it was quite a cultural shock, if you will. But I have to say, after a couple of semesters of the PA program, I fell in love with West Virginia, as well as my future wife, Shelley Combs, who now is a retired oncology PA. As for being a PA student, much of the time I spent studying and attending classes. My classmates included a couple of Vietnam vets who helped out with some of the instructions. So we were well trained. I was assigned to complete my clinical clerkship at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston, South Carolina. So I spent my last year in this baccalaureate program. That's a little bit about my beginnings.
That's great. Thank you so much for that. Glenn, you've seen that the PA profession evolved
Significantly since the 1970s. And like you and I, we started when we were 12, so we're still pretty young. But what do you consider from then to now, what do you consider the most transformative change in PA practice during your career?
Well, I kind of answered that by saying it was interesting, particularly during the clinical year. They had no idea what a PA was or how they were going to train them. So I ended up doing a lot of things that, current PA students do not do now. I mean, I'm talking about a BK amputation, thoracentesis, obviously deep central lines, things that, would be kind of see one, do one, teach one kind of attitude. Now that gives you some idea as far as having changes between now and then. It's amazing. It's amazing how things sort of worked out for me personally. I felt probably starting to list a few things that I thought were most significant as far as what we accomplished. One of them, I think, was to see that state legislation in the country was a most important thing, and that we saw PA legislation and rules and regulations come about after hard lobbying. Lobbying was a very important thing. I actually was a lobbyist in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and I learned a lot about how laws came about. And I have also commented that I really didn't think that I should bus children into Frankfurt to see what actually does go on in the legislature. It was sort of interesting. I always felt, and I tried to temper my thoughts about how PA laws came about. It had nothing to do with the quality of care that we could provide. It had everything to do with power. And what I mean by that is that though a legislator had fairly, I guess, not a very good idea of what our PAs were going to work on how they were. But they also knew that Senator so-and-so had a piece of my legislation, and if I voted for his legislation, he'd vote for my legislation. So the whole issue of quality and, the fact that PAs were going to make a tremendous, remark on how medical worked out. It was not that at all. It had a lot to do with that kind of politically getting things actually started. Medicare had a significant role, and I think we can credit Carl Fassler, who was a past president of the AAPA, in helping to see Medicare reimbursement come about. And that gave us more credibility and also setting up more of a reimbursement for third-party payers to look at. Many third-party payers actually look at Medicare as sort of the standard in regards to how things came about. So that was a very good thing. We saw the proliferation of PA programs, which was exciting. AB was one of the 18 programs at the time of my graduation. I guess now there's well over 350 PA programs, and a few in international areas.
Yeah,
I was going to say there's so many achievements, Randy, over the past 60 years that I really take a great deal of pride in. The graduates of today have so much to be grateful for the first PA pioneers to help us grow and prosper with their blood, sweat, and tears.
I have a hard time thinking about this, about, here you are, and a number of folks in your position who had graduated from a bachelor's degree program, and going before a state legislature and advocating for a profession that hardly any.
Anybody knew, what it was. And like you were saying earlier, legislators had one thing in mind, and that was power. So, it took a lot of something, intentional fortitude, I think, about of standing in front of a legislature. I've done it myself for many years, and it's quite an experience, don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely is. You find out who your friends are.
That's right. That's right. Well, and I think one thing I learned.
In front of the Arizona legislature is that you had to know who your friends were going in, and that you had to know when to stand up and speak and when to sit down and shut up.
That's right.
And it took those kind of folks over the years to do that. Let me sort of move on. You've had a unique opportunity to be a department chair for two PA programs, both at the University of Kentucky and then Wake Forest. What motivated your decision to get, first of all, get into academia, number one, and then number two, at Wake Forest, to move from a certificate to a master's degree?
Early on, I had already started to practice in family medicine specifically, but the idea of being able to be part of a PA program and to go up the ranks in the faculty from a junior, then becoming a program director, was something I wanted to do, and I needed a master's degree. There was no question about it. At the time, there were no master PAs. I think Jim Colley and I were counting. We counted about six people who had a master's degree at those early years. And so I went to Michigan State and got a degree in instructional design and higher ed and administration. So that was one of the things that I wanted to do.
So you were a Michigan State Spartan?
Yes, I was.
Oh my gosh.
East Lansing.
Yeah, they just started a PA program there a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Well, that's great. Glenn, also, in your career, you've served twice. Maybe we should, get one of our psychiatry folks to discuss this, but you've served twice as AAPA president with terms 14 years apart. So, A, tell us a little bit about those two terms, and then how did the AAPA's priorities shift between your first and your second presidency?
I was encouraged to run for president by Judy Willis and Charlie Huntington, if those names mean
Oh yeah,
very
they mean a
people.
lot.
I thought a lot about it. I was there at that particular time. I was a program director at University of Kentucky. So I thought I'd put my hat in, and I won. And my first year for my first tenure as a president of the AAPA, I felt it was extremely important that we really begin talking to the AMA and the American Academy of Family Practice, as well as ASA, which is the American Surgical Association, to get on a try to reach a first name basis, if you will. We had a lot of resistance, and it took a considerable amount of time and effort to get some of these people to get around. It's interesting that the one way that we got the American Academy of Family Practice up on board was that they insisted that we have a recertification component to our annual certification. And we said yes, we would pursue that. And so the commission was really established out of their interest in getting us to do just that. There was also a lot of turf guarding. There was concern that somehow PAs were going to take over more responsibility than need. And so we had to sort of put those fires out a number of times. So it took a lot of time communicating in person, which we tried to do as much as we could, attending the AMA convention, as well as the AFP conference. Judy Willis was the president at that time, and she could light up a room for you. I mean, when it came to really getting to the people that we needed to speak with, she could certainly make those types of arrangements. And we were very fortunate to have Judy.
Yeah, Judy was the first woman president of AAPA.
That's right. First woman president.
And how about your second term of presidents? How was that different, or was it?
The second year was more devoted to trying to increase membership of the academy to get as many PAs signed on. I was mostly interested in trying to do what I could to strengthen chapters of the AAPA, providing some leadership programs for their officers, and also to start strategic planning, which was critically important in our ability to lay down a strategic plan that we could all follow and be successful with.
Yeah, very good. Let's take up shifting a little bit back to clinical practice. Now, for many years you did emergency medicine and surgery, but I as long as I've known you in the last few decades, you've had a love for psychiatry. Tell us a little bit about your shift from emergency medicine surgery into psychiatry and what's that meant to you and in your career.
Well, psychiatry itself was at the end of my career. I spent 11 years in psychiatry before I actually retired. As you mentioned, I had done OBGYN in primary care, academic medicine. And one of the things I realized was I had become a pretty good listener. And I think that's a hallmark of a PA, is to be able to listen to a patient and to feel that their concerns or problems were taken seriously. So I felt good about that. I felt that being able to interact with patients. But the thing that was lacking was mental health. I think we still don't do a great service in mental health. So really, psychiatry came to me fairly naturally. I enjoyed it. I actually thought maybe I should have done it sooner than later.
Yeah, well said. And it's such an important thing throughout all specialties, including primary care. Going back a little bit, we were talking about this before we actually started, and that's your role in advocating for particularly Navy PAs in commissioning, but commissioning for all the services. And so, thinking back, what were some of the main obstacles in achieving, the commissioning for Navy PAs, for instance?
Well, both the Air Force and the Army had already made good strides in seeing, their officers commissioned. The Navy was the last branch of the military to actually see PA commissioning. I was on sabbatical from the University of Kentucky, so I literally lived in Washington. Actually, my apartment was in Arlington, but I had access to a lot of different things that were going on at the time, particularly as it related, to PAs. I was invited to give a talk or a graduation speech, I guess, to the Portsmouth Navy PAs, and I said I agreed to do it, and but I had to submit my speech to the lieutenant commander, who was the PA program director at the time. Randy, it came back all redlined. I mean, the things that I was going to say, it just sort of shocked me for a minute then. But I could not talk about commissioning. I could not talk about a wartime mission. Anything related to commissioning was just inked out. And so I looked at that, and I said, okay, I'm still going to do it. But I knew that there was going to be an admiral in that audience. I knew there was going to be an admiral there. So, I took a risk, but I decided to start talking. And this time I was talking directly to him. And I said, it's time. We all know that the Army and the Air Force are now commissioned. And, why don't we help these new graduates here with their commissioning efforts? And I went on a few other provocative things that I had said, but I didn't care. So at the end of the talk, I went up to the admiral and asked him if he had any questions. He kind of looked at me as if, how did you get by talking like that? Anyway, he said, I appreciate your remarks, and that was it. And about, I don't know, a month or two went by, and Lynn May, who was the CEO at the time of the AAPA, and I went down to the Pentagon, and we did talk to some high standing Navy officers that were part of the Bureau of Medicine and Surgery, and talked to them a little bit more about it. And they hemmed and hawed, particularly the admiral that we were talking to. I had a few questions, but not much. And we both left, Lynn and I both kind of left thinking, I don't know how much of an influence we had, but within 9 months we had Navy commissioning. And I'm quite proud of that.
Well, as you should be, and it has says something about, speaking truth to power at the right time.
Yeah.
So yeah, thank you for that.
Sure.
Another thing that sort of I wanted to ask you earlier, and that is, we talked about in the introduction that you were working as an RN in California. How did your experience as a nurse influence your approach to PA education and practice?
Well, I knew that I was not going to be totally satisfied of it just being an RN. I knew that there was some other things that I wanted to do. I really didn't want to go into administration. And that's when my aunt sent me the article. I believe it was a Look article about the Duke PA program. So, and when I did the research that, as I mentioned earlier, I learned that this is probably the thing that I was looking for. And it matched what I saw myself moving into. So the RN, the nursing background, certainly was a leg up in regards to studying and knowing a lot about the nursing concept, but I knew that I was moving more or less into a medical practice role.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure a lot of people know this, some of the younger PAs, but in the very early parts of our profession, the majority of classes were military corpsmen, army medics like that, and nurses. And a lot of nurses had decided to move into PA education for many of the issues that you just talked about. And I think that continues certainly from the nursing profession. We wish that we could find, more of our military veterans moving into PA education today. But yeah, very, very, very interesting. Another issue that comes up in your career is telemedicine and virtual medicine. Tell us a little bit about that you've been involved in.
Well, if there's one silver lining around COVID, it's telemedicine. We literally closed our psychiatric practice down. Patients could not come into our lobby. And all of us in the practice began learning more about telemedicine. And for the year and a half that we were closed down, telemedicine was our way of reaching out to patients. And I was able to communicate, obviously, with therapy that was required by that patient, but I also could write scripts. I could actually write a prescription for the medications that they were on. And it turned out to be a wonderful thing. I mean, a number of my patients did their sessions in their cars so that they would, have some privacy. I've interviewed some patients on the beach, and it's a wonderful thing. And then I think the other thing that's so dramatic about telemedicine is that, when you need to see, a young woman and two children, the last thing you want to do is to tell them to bring their children into a lobby that's full of infection and other things. So I was able to do most of my appointments in their homes. And when you see patients in their homes, you find out a whole lot more things than if you were seeing them in the office. And that again was a real plus. I'm a great believer in telemedicine, and I think everybody's offering it now as one of the benefits. I saw last night, I think there was an insurance policy that accepted telemedicine. And I thought, well, we've moved quite a ways on this. I'm glad to have that.
Yes, we have. I want to talk a little bit about your contributions to the PA History Society. I know you've been involved with them, and as you know, I'm a current trustee. And every time I talk to the folks down there, they've heard from you about sharing something that about the history profession. What do you think that the profession should know about the PA History Society, and why is that crucial for current students to understand?
I think the History Society serves a very important purpose, particularly in PA education. I've often wondered if the new generations ever really look back to see some of these PA pioneers that played such a significant role in seeing the profession develop. And you've done a marvelous job. Your website and information that you've been able to collect is wonderful. I made my trip down to Atlanta. My last trip out down there was to bring Hugh C. Myers memorabilia. Dr. Hugh died, I think it was in 98, but he left so many things. As I mentioned, Dr. Hugh was a surgeon, and he was also an innovator. He developed something called the intermittent irrigator, and Bert might remember this thing. But after a suprapubic prostatectomy, we would run water in and out with this intermittent irrigator, which was saline to help prevent clotting. I was awakened probably 3 or 4 in the morning to come down to service the machine. And I'll share this. I went in. The nursing supervisor was quite concerned. I was half asleep, I have to admit. But there was a puddle of water next to the bed, and I stepped in it. At the same time, I grabbed a cord that was the electrical cord, and I thought I was going to die. I had the worst shock of my life. But These are things, though, that you, there's many other kinds of surgical equipment and things of that sort that he designed and carried out. But he was really quite a wonderful person, and I got to operate with him, 8 inches from nose to nose a number of times during my surgical experience there at Broaddus Hospital. But I was glad to bring all of that, a lot of that memorabilia to the History Center, and hopefully it can be categorized and looked at.
Yes, so important to share the history. This won't surprise you, but the PA History Society did a little survey at the conference last year and asked, people that came by the booth, what war, did the PA profession actually come out of? And you'd be surprised, people even said the Continental War, the Korean War, World War II, Desert
Unbelievable.
Storm. I mean,
Yeah.
it is unbelievable. And I think all of us have a responsibility to start sharing what happened over the last 55 years, because things do reoccur. So anyway, thank you for reaching out to the PA
Sure.
History Society and sharing those things.
Sure.
So let's move on to a couple some professional issues. As you know, a number of years ago, the AAPA passed the optimum, team practice, as an important component of the PA profession. And what are your thoughts about, OTP?
Well, my thoughts are pretty strong, Randy.
Good.
I'm not sure it was worth all of the money and cost that it was associated with getting that as part of state legislation. I kind of felt I was already an OTP when I was practicing. I worked with a physician. I considered him a consult person in himself. I had access to other physician consults. And I really, really, the only thing that really sort of sticks out is the fact of the liability issue. I don't think, supervising or consulting physicians should be liable for the actions of a PA. I think they need to stand on their own. So that tenet of OTP was something that I felt strong about. But, generally speaking, I'm not sure it's gotten anywhere where we should be by now.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think the one component of OTP that I support, and that is the development of PA-specific regulatory boards. And, right now, I think there's five or six states that actually, Arizona, one of them, that has a PA regulatory board with a majority or almost majority of PAs on the board. And I think for us to, I mean, nurses have it, physicians have it, physical therapists have it, on and on. Why don't PAs have it? And I think, I wish we would spend more time working with states to get their regulatory board that's specific to PAs. I think that would help our profession a lot. What are your thoughts on that?
I certainly agree. I think, pursuing that sort of arrangement, even if it's a subgroup of the medical board, with its own chair and policy and regs, is probably something we should continue to pursue. I think we'll get there, though. I do believe that it'll happen.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about it, let's hit on the title change, to physician associate. That it's been what, 4 or 5 years now since the House of Delegates approved that, and many specialty organizations have changed their name. I think Oregon changed their state chapter name to physician associate. Your thoughts on that?
I was in favor of physician associate. There's two reasons. One, I felt that we were should not be considered anymore as an assistant. Okay. So I thought moving that, and some people would argue there's nothing different between an assistant and associate. Well, getting rid of the assistant in our lexicon, it was to me very important. The other thing that I favored physician associate is that even though we've had our skirmishes with organized medicine, I don't think we should separate ourselves from a physician. I think we need to stay in that camp. And some of the ideas of making a title like medical practitioner, though I understood where people were coming from with that, I just didn't think we were really at this stage of the game want to just pronounce our independence. I think there has to be a collegial type relationship between you and the physician that you work with or physicians. So often now, PAs are being, quote, supervised by doctors who they rarely know. I mean, particularly in corporate medicine, you see this. You're assigned a physician, and the PA is pretty still working fairly autonomously and independent. And so that becomes sort of an interesting come about. Ways
Yeah,
to get around, ways to get around the supervising clause.
well said. When we know that now the majority, I think it's well over 60%, maybe even 70% of physicians work for an entity. They're not in a cottage industry now, and so both PAs and physicians are working for the same company, and physicians that are assigned, collaboration or supervision, whatever the state law requires, and it becomes kind of an arduous situation. And I think oftentimes both physicians and the PAs feel a little uncomfortable about that, don't you think?
I do. I agree completely. My wife and I, as I mentioned, is a retired oncology PA, have had this discussion a number of times. I would ask her, well, what did your supervising physician say? And she said, well, I haven't spoken to him for the past 6 months. That's the reality of it now. So.
Yep, I think you're right on target with that. And another issue is it's becoming to the forefront now with PAEA and both AAPA having task force looking on the issue of entry-level doctoral degree PA education. And you and I have been and Bert have been around for so many years. We remember when PAs were certificates, then bachelor's, then master's, and now the debate regarding entry-level doctoral degree and PA education. Some people say, the train has left the station, it's going to happen. What are your thoughts? And what, yeah, let's stop there. What are your thoughts about entry-level doctoral degree for PAs?
Well, I have to say that I'm glad that DMS is here. I support it. I think it was the right thing to have done as far as the PA involvement. And I do feel that way because I know that there are a number of graduates who wanted to learn more about organizational skills, administration, research, and that's an opportunity for them to take advantage of. As far as being a terminal degree, I think that's in the wings. I think it's going to happen. Has a lot to do with PAEA or PA Educational Association, of course. It's going to cost more to see it because we're going to need more faculty with doctoral degrees to be able to take care of, and the curriculum itself will have to be lengthened. Now I think it's a little ways off, but I do believe it's going to come. And I do know that just like the master's degree, when it started, once one program develops that terminal doctoral degree, others will follow.
Right on target. I think you're right. So I appreciate that. I have a couple of questions before we head to some other questions from the folks who are here. This is not a question that I gave to you in advance, but it's come up a couple of times. You're married to a PA. How has that been in your career?
That's the best thing in my life.
Well, good answer.
My children, though, spend a lot of dinners talking about medical comics and topics, and I haven't turned either one of them into medicine or nursing, though.
Yeah, I have the same thing. I have many children, and none of them have decided to either move into medicine, go on to secondary education, or get married. So I somehow I've messed up.
I think I caused it because of the dinner chat that we had.
Oh, that's Glenn, before I ask your last question, what advice would you give to our DMSC students and our graduates? As you know, the all of our DMSC students are PAs who have been out in practice for as short time as 2 or 3 years, and as long as 40 years. 2 years ago, we had a 70-year-old PA graduate from our program. Everybody does it for different reasons, whether they want to move into education, academia, whether they want to move into a leadership role, whether they just want to enhance their clinical practice. What advice do you give our DMSC graduates?
I think there's a great deal of opportunity. We need more VPs, more vice presidents in hospital settings, CEOs, and members of corporate boards. And I believe the PA of the future who's prepared at their doctoral level can help us promote our profession. And that's what I would certainly advise people to really give serious consideration.
Very good. Well, here's my last question, Glenn, for you. You're retired now. And so tell us what you do for fun.
Randy, I think I work harder now than I have when I was actually in practice. I've tried to really pick my battles, if you will. I've taken up watercoloring. That's something new. I'm reading more, and we still vacation at the beach, which I find wonderful. A lot of fun.
Well, that's great. I have to thank you for a lot of things, but we've been friends for many years. But for the folks that are here, Glenn came out to Arizona back in 1995 or 96 as our first consultant to the our beginning PA program and help us put that together. And Glenn has been a good friend over these many years, through thick and thin, so many things. And Glenn, thank you for that. Let me open the floor, and I'm going to put Dr. Simon on alert as a fellow Alderson Broaddus graduate. Bert, do you have any comments or questions for Glenn?
Well, I certainly share Glenn's admiration of Dr. Myers. He was just a model physician. I mean, you can't think of a more ideal healer. My time with him, Glenn, he wasn't doing much of any surgery, but I did get to spend weeks with him in the clinic downtown there and in Philippi. And it was just a great experience every day to watch him interact with people. And also to listen to him every day, he would tell me about don't watch television, that it's gonna, it's evil, it's not good for you. Yes. I wonder when you were down at on rotation in South Carolina, was Curtis Arts there? Did you get to work with him?
Yes, I did. Dr. Arts was the chairman of the Department of Surgery, and he was really our go-to person in regards to where we were going to spend time in the various clerkships that we had to do. He was quite a guy. I remember the first time I met Dr. Arts, he was sitting on his chair, and he had a fairly elaborate-looking office, which I guess a chief of surgery should have. But he had a can of peanuts, I guess it was, but he was sitting there with cross-legged with this can of peanuts eating, and he was so happy to see us. Mike Lewis, who was a colleague of mine or a classmate of mine, the two of us actually drove down to interview, and we got very excited seeing him, knowing that he was an international known burn surgeon in the Army, particularly. But Dr. Arts was had quite a influence on me personally.
If I may take a second and just tell one of my Hugh Myers stories. During the time that I was at AB, I think it was a little different when Glenn was there. They accepted 100 students into the pre-PA program. And then we went for 2 semesters. And then they selected 50 of us to continue and the other ones were gone. And so it was extremely competitive. And one of the things that you had to do was you had to have three interviews with program faculty. And I got my note for my first interview. And of course, you're very nervous. And the interview was with Dr. Hugh. And I said, all the people, I got the guy that, started the program, the famous surgeon. And I went in the office. I really think my hands were shaking. And I was just so taken aback. He took my coat off and hung it up and held the chair for me. It was just such a transformation in how I thought it was going to go. Such a wonderful man.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
He was a very nice person in general, as well as a technician. Every surgery that I participated in was an anatomy lesson. And Dr. Yu would like to quiz you to the point where you didn't know the answer.
That's wonderful. Thank you guys, both of you, for sharing that.
We need a lot more Hugh Myers in our society, that's for sure. Let me open it up to other folks that are here tonight that might have a question or a comment for Glenn Combs. Just unmute yourself and don't be afraid.
I love questions.
That's it. We can wait. I see Melinda on here. I see Nicole. Certainly, you guys have something to say. And Abby and Kendra.
Hi, this is Melinda. I'm sorry, I was trying to unmute myself on my phone. But just wanted to thank Glenn for all the contributions that he's made to our profession. I don't really have a question. Been a fascinating conversation. I've really appreciated it. But I just wanted to, personally thank him for his contributions to our profession. It's been a lot and very much appreciated.
Well, thank you.
Go ahead and jump in. So I asked this question a little earlier on the post, but Glenn, I think I get a feeling for what you're going to say, but how do you envision PA autonomy in the future?
I think it's going to continue to increase. And we have a variety of people, particularly new grads versus people who have had 20 years in the profession. Obviously, those people who are much more experienced clinically are going to have a lot more autonomy. And I like to think that we have been successful, but I kind of like to define the relationship between a PA and a physician as collegial, not up or down or however you want to look at it. But I think it's important that we do more to support that idea. And it might be in our ability to spend time in leadership skills. I think it's also critically important that PA programs themselves discuss that clearly, with their students, in regards to what it's going to be. You are no longer an assistant to a physician if you can't row, if you will. You're just not going to make it. You have to have confidence in your ability, and to be able to stand up for yourself. And that's how I feel.
I would tend to agree with you. Thanks.
Sure.
All right. Who else out there brave enough to bring up a question or comment? All right. Well, we're getting close to the end of this. Glenn, before I have the
Last few words. How about any last words from you in terms of comments, about tonight and comments about the future?
Well, listen, I do appreciate, what you've done here, Randy. You and your staff have put together a wonderful tool, which I'm sure you're going to lend to the History Society. I certainly would encourage to market it that way too. But it's just been a pleasure, tripping down memory lane here. You've asked a lot of me. I mean, like I said earlier, this all started in 68, 1968. I often wonder if I did the right thing, and I now know I did. Even though Ronald Reagan, the governor of California, closed our universities during the student Vietnam protest, that actually worked out for me because I would not have been to West Virginia without that happening to me.
Well, we're thank you, Ronald Reagan. And thank you, Glenn Combs, for
Yes.
your multitude of decades for the profession, and not only for the profession, for the patients that we serve. And we will never know, what kind of inroads we've made. We continue to sow the seeds that future generations, will harvest. So thank you for your time tonight, and bless you, and please give our best to your wife as well.
Thank you. Thank you. It was my pleasure, Randy. Thank
Great
you
to
so
see you,
much.
Glenn.
And
You're very
before we go, I just want to thank everybody's time. We will have a May class. I will send information out about that. And until then, have a great evening, and I'll see you down the road.
Thank you.